This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. This episode continues the serialization of Dr. David Lankus's book, Expect More, Demanding Better Libraries for Today's Complex World.
Two, the argument for better libraries. Expect impact. Cushing Academy is an elite prep school about 70 miles west of Boston. On its lush wooded campus, 445 students from 28 states and 28 countries work through high school. It is also, if you believe the Boston Globe, the end of libraries as we know them. In 2009, Cushing invested hundreds of thousands of dollars renovating its library. A large part of that investment was getting rid of all physical books and replacing them with e-readers and digital resources. At least, that's what the Globe reported. The truth is more complex. Cushing did indeed get rid of a large number of printed books, mostly out-of-date research texts. It did this in order to actually expand the collection of materials available to students through digital means. It also increased the library staff and allowed students to access the resources of the library 24/7. The interesting part of this story is not that a school eliminated its print collection. It didn't. Or even the changing nature of the library's collection, increasingly digital. No, the interesting part of this story is the press reaction to the change at a small boarding school. In headlines like, "Digital School Library Leaves Book Stacks Behind," and "Welcome to the Library, Say Goodbye to the Books," reporters seemed to push past the nuance of a school expanding its library and looked for the end of libraries. The central argument of this book is that we need better libraries. This presupposes that we need libraries in the first place. There are plenty of voices that question the need for any library. Before we jump into what you should expect from your library, it is worth reviewing the arguments for libraries in the first place. The core argument for libraries throughout time and today cluster around a few key themes: collective buying agent, economic stimulus, center of learning, safety net, steward of cultural heritage, cradle of democracy, symbol of community aspirations. In truth, these cases for libraries are rarely made in isolation, and many of them have fuzzy boundaries. But it is worth looking at them and showing how we must expect more of how these cases are made. Let's take a look at these one at a time. Collective buying agent. Stuart Brand famously said, "Information wants to be free." At least that is what everyone quotes him as saying. The full quote is, "On the one hand, information wants to be expensive because it is so valuable. The right information in the right place just changes your life. On the other hand, information wants to be free because the cost of getting it out is getting lower and lower all the time. So you have these two fighting against each other." We see the results of this fight all over the place. Books and music are cheaper because distribution and production costs have been greatly diminished through digital networks. Academics are increasingly putting their papers online, and sites like YouTube show there's a healthy community willing to share videos and content of all sorts for free. However, take a deeper look and you see that quote-unquote free isn't as cheap as it's cracked up to be. YouTube videos are free to watch as long as you also watch a few commercials, just like broadcast TV. Have you seen your cable bill recently? Not free. Movie ticket prices are rising, and if you want to get medical advice beyond WebMD, you better have health insurance. Business models are changing, but quality information or personalized information still cost real money. To that end, libraries have always been one way in which communities pool resources to make bigger purchases. In universities, these purchases are things like academic journal subscriptions. In public libraries, pooled resources mean shared popular reading material. In schools, it is article database subscriptions and media. In law offices, this includes LexisNexis and legal resource databases like Westlaw. The point is that if a resource is too expensive for one person and that resource has general utility, then pooling community assets, taxes, tuition, and departmental budgets, makes sense. In fact, when libraries find materials have become too expensive, they even team up into consortia. To give you a small sense of how much money we're talking about, let me show you two quick examples. The first is a table put together by the University of Iowa that shows how much it costs for the university to provide academic journal titles electronically to faculty and staff. For the publisher Elsevier, the cost is $1,641,530 to get access to 2,095 journal titles. Wiley-Blackwell, $868,031 for 1,304 titles. Springer, $607,540 for 400 titles. Sage, $243,647 for 608 titles. JSTOR, $97,602 for 2,319 titles. Cambridge UP, $43,940 for 145 titles. Project Muse, $33,210 for 500 titles. And Oxford UP, $21,313 for 250 titles. You read that right. It costs over $3.5 million a year for 7,621 journal titles. Oh, and by the way, that's per year. The library never owns those articles. We'll come back to that when we talk about libraries as of the community in Chapter 5. Of course, you may consider that cheap when you see what the state of Texas found. The state runs a service called TechShare through its State Library and Archive Commission, TSLAC. TechShare provides large databases of research information to the citizens of Texas through participating libraries. Here's what Texas found in terms of cost. Quote, it would have cost the 677 libraries participating in the TechShare database program $97,044,031 to purchase the database subscriptions that were purchased by the TSLAC for $7,042,558. $90 million in savings. That's the power of collective purchasing. There are two factors that sometimes get lost when talking about libraries as collecting buying agents. Purchased items need organization, and using common funds should contribute to the common good. Let's start with items needing organization. For my son's 5th birthday, my wife and I bought him 10 pounds of Legos from eBay. It turns out when kids move out of the house and leave behind a drawer full of Legos, some parents box them up, weigh them, and sell them. This works great for a 5-year-old with an imagination, but not if he or she wants to build a particular thing. Lego is about imagination, but it is also about instructions and putting together sets around particular themes, space, Star Wars, etc. Simply buying Legos by the pound doesn't serve this purpose. The situation is the same with books and databases in a library. You need to invest in people who can organize these purchased, or more often these days, licensed, materials. We'll come back to this in Chapter 7 when we talk about librarians. The second concept that can get lost in the discussion of libraries as purchasing agents is the notion of the common good. That is, if a community, a school, a city, a college, pools its money to acquire things, those things should benefit the community as a whole. That may seem obvious, but libraries and communities can miss this point. Let's take a relatively new service called Freegal. Libraries subscribe to Freegal to allow library cardholders to download music from the Sony Music Collections as MP3 files. Libraries purchase blocks of downloads, for example, 500 downloads for the community. This sounds like a great service, except that the library, and therefore the community, is paying to allow one library user to download a song for that member's personal use. If another library member wants that song, it will require another download. The libraries, read the community, paying for the service, cannot collect these songs and lend them out or archive them. Imagine walking into a library, asking for a book, and having the librarian go over to a bookstore to purchase it, and then hand it to you to keep. Is this a wise use of community resources? Now imagine using tax funds to build a private road that only one citizen can use. It builds no common resource, brings no economy of scale, and ultimately uses the community pool to enrich individuals. Freegal is an example of wealth redistribution at its worst. The mission of libraries is not about wealth redistribution. You must expect it to build a commons, a common infrastructure, for the whole community to use. economic stimulus. Related to the collective buying agent argument is the idea that libraries of all types boost the economy of the community. In Indiana, researchers found that, quote, libraries are a good value. The direct economic benefit that communities receive from libraries are significantly greater than the cost to operate the libraries, unquote. Specifically, Indiana communities receive $2.38 in direct economic benefit for each dollar of cost. Public library salaries and expenditures generate an additional $216 million in economic activity in Indiana. Academic library salaries and expenditures generate an additional $112 million in economic activity in Indiana. In Wisconsin, they are apparently even getting a better value for their dollar, finding that, quote, the total economic contribution of Wisconsin public libraries to the Wisconsin economy is $753,699,545. The return on investment in library services is $4.06 for each dollar of taxpayer investment, unquote. Just so you don't think I cherry-picked two good states, in Colorado, $5 return for every $1 of investment. Florida, $6.54 return for every dollar investment. In Wisconsin, it was $4.06. Indiana, $2.38. Pennsylvania, $5.50. South Carolina, $4.48. Vermont, $5.36. In Charlotte, North Carolina alone, between $3.15 and $4.57 were returned for each dollar of investment. In St. Louis, Missouri, $4 returned for every dollar of investment. Southwestern Ohio, $3.81. Suffolk County, New York, $3.93. And in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, $3.05 were returned per $1 of investment. Where does all this economic boosting come from? Well, in part, it is from the collective buying power of libraries that was previously discussed. If you don't have to buy a book or rent a movie because you can use a library resource, that's a boost. In part, it comes from the fact that libraries are employers with employees who pay taxes and contribute to the local economy. But this goes beyond saving money. For example, recent studies showed that libraries actually lead to more book buying. In higher education, libraries are an important consideration when students select a university or college, and as a result, academic libraries can help institutional admissions boost enrollment. The economic impact of libraries also comes from intangibles like creating a civic environment to attract businesses and workforce development. More recently, during the economic downturn of the past few years, libraries have taken on an important role in helping job seekers. In some libraries, this is simply providing out-of-work folks with access to computers and resume workshops. In other libraries, however, we see what happens when communities and librarians expect more. For example, let's take a look at TransformU. This is a project of several public libraries in Illinois. These librarians recognize that when people are looking for a job, they are often looking for a bigger change in life. Maybe they would be better suited to going back to school. Maybe they need social services to help them feed their families. They definitely need to feel a sense of respect and self-worth. To meet these needs, the librarians created partnerships with local colleges, social service agencies, and economic development agencies. Now, when job seekers go to the local library, they have a whole support network that helps them identify their long-term goals and navigate sometimes confusing application sites at colleges and government agencies. They are provided with simple web tools for job seeking or creating businesses from scratch. These librarians went beyond the resources that they collected directly to meeting the needs of the community. A small library in rural Eureka, Illinois, shows another way in which libraries can contribute to economic development: entrepreneurship. When a woman approached the Eureka Public Library about starting a catering business, something wonderful happened. The woman had seen that there was a need for more lunch spots in town. She was a trained commercial chef and had an idea to start a new restaurant, but didn't know how to proceed. Rather than simply point her to some resources on starting a business, the library gave her a corner of its property where once a week, at first, the woman could set up a lunch spot. Over time, it became a regular spot. Chef Katie was able to create a successful catering business, and the whole town benefited. Eureka is not alone in helping community members find jobs and start businesses. The Dallas Public Library has cleared a significant portion of its fifth floor, replacing bookshelves with desks and whiteboards. They invite local entrepreneurs to set up shop within the library rent-free. Rather than pitching their ideas in their own homes, these entrepreneurs now use conference rooms. This startup spirit is not limited to public libraries. Syracuse University's School of Information Studies has a strong emphasis on startups, often forming undergraduate students from around the campus into idea and business-generating teams. Librarians sit down with these teams to do competitive analysis and research the novelty of their ideas. In corporations around the country, corporate libraries are breaking patents, sizing up competition, and providing ongoing training to lawyers, doctors, and computer manufacturers to help grow businesses. Libraries, as we know them, provide economic benefit to their communities. However, as we move forward, we can expect more of them in this regard. We should expect libraries of all types to save communities money and help spark whole new industries. Center of Learning. This argument for libraries rests on the widely held belief that the best learning happens in the richest information environment. In academic institutions, this has translated into libraries that seek to comprehensively collect scholarly works and journals. In public libraries, this has meant collecting materials on a wide variety of subjects, not just popular fiction. It is the reason that school libraries exist. Literacy, learning, and scholarship have always been associated with libraries. In fact, most directors of libraries in the Middle Ages were scholars who also maintained the collection. This trend continues today. The U.S. Library of Congress is headed by an historian. In the 1900s, this argument that libraries are places of learning drove the work of public libraries as, quote, the people's university, unquote. Melville Dewey, father of the Dewey Decimal System, believed public libraries and public schools were co-equal educational institutions. In fact, public libraries did not collect fiction or any popular materials because folks at the time did not connect general literacy or the love of reading, as we talk about it today, with learning. Today, libraries still have the concept of learning within their missions. One of the most successful national marketing campaigns in any industry is the American Library Association's Read posters that feature celebrity to encourage everyone to pick up a book and read. Summer reading programs encourage a habit of reading, a necessary skill for lifelong learning. School libraries are deeply engaged in literacy instructions, moving from basic reading skills to research skills to critical thinking exercises with the curriculum. Even academic and corporate libraries engage in literacy instruction, though focused on media and social literacy, like deciphering trends in social media or understanding data visualization. However, while I assert that this argument for libraries is increasingly important, it is often a vague justification. For example, is it enough to create a resource-rich environment to facilitate learning? If I were to drop off a 2-year-old in the middle of a well-stocked library, could I expect to come back in 2 days and have the child reading? Of course not. Part of expecting more from your library and librarians is to force them to move past common-sense-sounding arguments into measurable activities. For example, does your public library work directly with K-12 school districts? How does an academic library's collection match the degree programs being offered at a college? What courses, curriculum, and services are being offered by whom to whom and with what outcome? Simply stockpiling resources is not enhancing education, it is hoarding. We will return to these themes throughout the rest of the book, but for now let us move on to libraries and the social safety net. Safety net. When you think of the social safety net, you probably think about the poor. To be sure, libraries provide access to a world of resources and services to those least able to afford it. However, the safety net that libraries extend goes far beyond one socioeconomic stratum. Very few individuals can afford the hundreds of thousands of dollars libraries pay for searchable databases. But the safety net argument goes beyond simply paying for resources as well. Public libraries have long brought information to those otherwise unable to acquire it. This is in part the buying agent mission we talked about before, but today's safety net also includes bringing internet access to rural America. These days, libraries are adding internet connections to small village libraries and bookmobiles as a way of serving people in rural locations. A 2008 study showed that 3/4 of public libraries are the only providers of free access to the internet in their community. In Vermont, the state government is building a gigabit fiber network that will connect rural libraries across the state, making each library an access point for village businesses and homes. In these days of digital networks, libraries of all types have extended the social safety net beyond access to bridge the new growing digital divide, knowledge. While there is still a significant challenge in getting people connected to the internet, and while digital tools are becoming increasingly necessary to life and work, the challenge is now helping people take advantage of these new tools. For example, after Christmas 2011, public libraries were flooded with people who had received iPads and Kindle Fires for the holiday. Many had bought or received the tablets unaware that you needed a wireless network to use them. So librarians helped set up the devices and showed folks how they could use the library's wireless network to get books, music, and video. If you extend this idea of filling the knowledge gap, you see that it is not just public libraries that are filling holes in safety nets. School libraries are now loaning out books not only to the students, but to their parents as well. In every academic library, librarians are providing the students basic research skills that are not covered in classes. Law librarians are adding vital information literacy to the legal skills in lawyers and judges alike. In the U.S. Department of Justice, some librarians are now part of prosecutorial teams. Their main job is researching expert witnesses to debunk their testimony in court. Here we again come to the point where we must expect more of libraries as we move forward. As governments shrink in the face of economic austerity, they are withdrawing direct support to the public. Tax services, job services, and social services are all shrinking their footprint and expecting libraries to pick up the slack as public contact points. As resumes go online, as business with the government goes online, and as literature and music go online, we need libraries and librarians prepared to go beyond handing out forms and pointing to computers. We need librarians to teach, solve problems, and ultimately advocate on behalf of the community. Steward of Cultural Heritage. On the third floor of the Philadelphia Free Library Central Library, you will find a library. Yes, another library inside the Free Library. It is the library of William McIntyre Elkins, a rich investment banker of Philadelphia at the turn of the 20th century and a noted collector of books. This is not a recreation made to look like the original. It was moved in its entirety from Elkins' house to the Free Library. Not just the books, but the desks, the globe, the wood-paneled walls, the carpet, the whole library of Elkins. It is, frankly, a bit disconcerting to walk into. However, it is not unusual for large libraries to have these special collections. The importance of libraries to the preservation of our cultural heritage is not an argument that you hear that often these days. The emphasis over the past 30 years has been on information and resources that have direct and immediate impact on scholarship, learning, and recreation. However, over the centuries, and in many other countries, the preservation of the cultural record, artwork, manuscripts, and such, was the primary reason behind libraries. It's why you will find an original folio of Shakespeare's works in the Dallas Public Library and a Gutenberg Bible at the University of Texas's Ransom Center. In the Nordic countries, libraries are often co-located with museums and theaters. And to this day, if you go to Italy and look for a public library, you'll be hard-pressed to find one. That is because they are not there for the casual user. They are there for the scholar or the student. As one Italian librarian put it to me, in Italy, we don't ask the library for a recipe for sauce, we ask our mothers. In other words, the library is not for daily tasks. Many U.S. libraries, particularly academic libraries, still build amazing collections of art and historical treasures. But the language of cultural heritage in libraries is also changing. Today, in addition to preserving cultural artifacts of the past, librarians are working with neighborhoods to capture the culture of the now. Ken Lavender, a professor of practice at Syracuse University, works with volunteers and students to go into the neighborhoods of Syracuse. There, they work with the residents to capture stories, digitize shoeboxes full of photos, and create oral histories so that the residents can pass their heritage down to future generations. Our history and how we saw ourselves in the past are vital parts of how we move forward. However, we should now expect our libraries to not simply act as storehouses of the works of great men of the past, but to also capture the story of what is unfolding today. Take the Elkins Library in Philadelphia. If you want to see it, you take an elevator to the third floor and ring a buzzer. Within about 20 minutes, someone will let you in to see it. We need our history at our fingertips so we can weave it into the future. Cradle of Democracy. To be clear, you can have libraries without democracy and democracy without libraries. One need only look through history. However, I would argue that in order to have a true liberal democracy, libraries are a requirement. The United States is a liberal democracy. Canada is a liberal democracy. France, Germany, India, and Israel are liberal democracies too. The liberal part of liberal democracy has nothing to do with a political party or even how socially progressive a country is. It refers to the belief that democracy is more than voting. A liberal democracy also includes protections of civil liberties and a constitutional protection from intrusive governmental power. It is an important modifier. Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, was nominally a democracy. Hussein was elected president with 99% of the vote. However, few would consider this truly liberal democracy. Why are libraries so important for a liberal democracy? The short answer is that a true democracy requires the participation of an informed citizenry. The core mission of libraries, public and otherwise, is creating a nation of informed and active citizens. When library supporters make this argument, they will often use one of these three quotes. Quote, "The people are the only censors of their governors, and even their errors will tend to keep these to the true principles of the institution. The way to prevent these errors is to give them full information of their affairs through the channels of public papers, and to contrive that these papers should penetrate the whole mass of the people. The basis of our government being the opinion of the people, the very first objective should be to keep that right. And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. But I should mean that every man should receive these papers and be capable of reading them." Unquote. Thomas Jefferson. Quote, "There is not such a cradle of democracy upon this earth as the free public library. This republic of letters where neither rank, office, nor wealth receives the slightest consideration." Unquote. Andrew Carnegie. Quote, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives." Unquote. James Madison. All three of these quotes share a common message: an informed citizen is necessary to sustain a democracy. However, each of these quotes emphasize a different facet of maintaining and participating in democracy. Jefferson is talking about transparency, Carnegie, access, and Madison, education. Good libraries take on all three of these. Let's start with transparency. Democracy and transparency. In the preceding quote, Jefferson is clearly talking about newspapers and the press, not libraries. Yet he is also emphasizing the necessity of transparency, which is a goal that librarians and journalists share. A functioning representative government of the people is not a, quote, fire and forget, unquote, thing. You don't simply vote politicians into office and wait for the next election. There must be oversight of the actions of elected officials to prevent abuse and to shape civic discourse and policy. Watergate was not resolved through an election, but through the emergence of documents and evidence of corrupt actions on the part of the elected government. Libraries further the goal of transparency in a number of ways. They work from within the government to document, archive, and disseminate the work of agencies. For example, if you want to know every law passed by the U.S. Congress, you can go to the Library of Congress website and search the Thomas database. If you would like access to research funded by the National Institutes of Health, click over to the National Library of Medicine and search the PubMed database. Libraries also further transparency outside of the federal government. Nearly 1,250 academic and public libraries around the country house government documents as part of the Federal Depository Library Program. If a government agency prints a report, brochure, form, or regulation, it is deposited at these libraries, which must ensure public access to these materials. Beyond the federal level, every state has a publicly accessible law library that houses the laws, regulations, and judicial decisions of the state. Many local libraries store the proceedings of town councils and county legislatures. The idea is that a citizen can observe the work of government and participate in decision-making. There are enormous challenges that libraries and all citizens face in terms of transparency, like archiving documents on ever-shifting websites, classification of documents, and more. But we'll return to those later. Democracy and access. What Carnegie talks about in the previous quote is equal access to the work of the state. Of course, he did more than just talk about it. He is considered a sort of patron saint for libraries after he built over 2,500 of them around the world. In Carnegie's day, access meant access to printed record of thoughts, books. Today, libraries of all sorts have extended that idea into many other channels. This is most clearly seen in the provision of the internet and public access computers in the public libraries. However, it is also seen in policies of all libraries that give out library cards to all citizens in a community free of charge. In many other countries, you must pay a fee for a card or to use the computers. For example, in the Netherlands, a library card costs 15 euros per year or 30 euros if you want to borrow books. If you would like to reserve books to borrow, 50 euros. The importance of access is also seen in academic libraries that allow for public access instead of restricting access to the faculty and students of a given college or university. The importance of access is seen in millions of dollars of state libraries are spending on statewide database licenses, giving equal access to these resources to urban, suburban, and rural communities alike. Of course, all the access in the world is useless if you don't know what to do with the information you are accessing. That was Madison's point. Democracy and education. Madison said, quote, "A people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives," unquote. What I absolutely love about this quote is the use of the active verb arm. Simply having access to information generated by a working democracy is not enough. Being able to look up a law online is useless if you can't read. Of course, even if you can read, can we also assume you know how to actually use a computer and get online in the first place? A functioning democracy must actively develop, or in Madison's words, arm, an educated population. This argument is central to the idea of public education in this country. Yet the public education sector is struggling with an increasingly codified curriculum and an 8% high school dropout rate, 17.6% in the Latino community. The public elementary and secondary education system doesn't even touch the roughly 12% of the adult U.S. population who lack basic literacy skills. Public libraries, school libraries, and academic libraries are all a part of educating the citizenry for democratic participation. It is an expansion of the safety net argument, but rather than a safety net for economic participation or well-being, it is a safety net for how we govern ourselves. Democracy and higher expectations. Democracy is not an easy thing. Democracy is not neat and tidy. In our daily lives, few of us take the time from our commutes, email, and daily struggles to think about where we fit in the democratic scheme of things. What's more is that in your library, you can find the books and computers, but where's the democracy? Is there an active effort by your library to prepare you to be an active citizen? Let me be clear. This is not about being political and ideological. The point is not asking whether your library is lined up with a party or a candidate. Rather, it is asking what difference the library has made in the governance of your community, be it in a town, a university, a school, or a corporation. Did you know that half of the Library of Congress's budget is devoted to something called the Congressional Research Service? The Congressional Research Service, CRS, quote, "works exclusively for the United States Congress, providing policy and legal analysis to committees and members of both the House and Senate, regardless of party affiliation. As a legislative branch agency within the Library of Congress, CRS has been a valued and respected resource on Capitol Hill for nearly a century," unquote. Does your library have a similar service to inform your local politicians, chancellor, president, CEO, principal? Shouldn't a good school library mean you have a well-informed principal? Part of raising expectations for our libraries is to move past rhetorical loose connections between democracy, informed community, and libraries, or else risk making one of the most important arguments for libraries ring hollow. Symbol of community aspirations. Libraries have always been about ideas, aspirations, and dreams of the individuals. Librarians can tell you amazing stories of people that they have helped, from saving a woman from an abusive relationship, to lifting a homeless man from poverty, to saving the life of a cancer patient, to inspiring wonder in a child. Libraries have had an impact on people's lives. Frankly, what I wish librarians would talk more about are the hopes and aspirations of the communities. Communities have dreams. They long to be world-class scholarly institutions or economic hubs. Communities dream about living comfortably or being market leaders. Sure, these dreams aren't always as well defined as those of individual community members, but they represent a sort of holistic desire that sets policy, assigns resources, and changes messages to the outside world. Libraries have become aspirational institutions. At the most basic, the building itself serves as a symbol for the community and the community's desire to be associated with knowledge. San Francisco, Seattle, Salt Lake City, and Vancouver all use new library buildings to revitalize their downtowns. The inspiring architecture of libraries has become the new cathedral, a concrete way for a community to make a statement of its importance. The power of architecture and the statements we seek to make with library buildings in particular cannot be denied. Donors at universities are naming libraries, and architects take great pride in academic libraries, sometimes celebrating the building over the library function itself. When it comes to expecting more, however, we must look at the power of the building versus the power of the services housed within, and more outside. Barbara Quint, a reporter at Information Today's Searcher magazine, once said that a library after hours is like a coral reef without the fish. It is beautiful and serene, but devoid of life. It is a remnant that can only remind us of a point in time. Likewise, if you take away the librarians and staff but leave the books, the computer, and the architecture, you will have a fine sculpture of a library that will become a snapshot of the community's past. But if you threw out the books and the buildings and left a dedicated group of library professionals, you could invite the public in and they would construct the future. Now more than ever, the future of any community is not in the riches we pull from the ground or the glass we send streaming into the sky, but in the decisions and talents of the community members. They are not passive consumers of libraries or content or an audience to democracy, but the very reason we are all here. They deserve a new librarianship, a new library that enables radical positive change. The reasons that I have just covered support why we have libraries in general. Frankly, you will hear these arguments from good and bad libraries alike. The real question is how these themes and justifications become reality in your community and how they must transform for libraries to continue to be relevant in the future.
Stay tuned next week for an all-new interview show and the following week for Expect More, Chapter 3. If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com. Or follow us on Twitter at CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.